I'm Josh Cooperman. This is Doctoring Up Design, the official podcast of Design Hardware. They can help you specify some of the world's greatest decorative hardware, building materials, wood floors, plus a selection of bespoke products that will elevate any project from ordinary to extraordinary. From LA to London to the Middle East, they ship anywhere and everywhere, so you have one trusted point of contact. On this episode of the podcast, you are going to hear from Terry Robison and Greg Blyer of Studio Unlimited. We cover a lot in the following hour, including interior design, architecture, and the nuts and bolts that make for an extraordinary design and architecture firm, but we also are talking specifically about designing for hospitality. The Sur Lounge, an emotional lounge with rounded everything. Try to find a 90-degree angle in this place. That's got to be tough to design. Saison, Bar Maruno, all extraordinary spaces. And there are many more where those came from, and we're going to talk about a few of them. So let's get into it with Greg Blyer and Terry Robison of Studio Unlimited. Design Hardware is your one-stop design resource for stunning hardware, flooring, and unique brands that allow designers to stand out and create incredible projects, like those from Velcromat, panel made of wood fibers that are colored in the production process. The colorant are chemically bound to one another in a special resin, which gives the end product a deep, rich color matched with custom textures and added dimension. This high-density product is moisture-resistant, high-density, higher strength, simple to work with, and yields extraordinary results. Design Hardware is where you will find brands blazing new trails like Velcromat. For more information about Velcromat by Investwood and other extraordinary companies changing the look and feel of luxury design, visit designhardware.com or on the socials at Design Hardware and Flooring. So funny, you said this is your first in person.
Yep.
And isn't it interesting because I pick up on that because prior to the pandemic, you know, after doing the show now for 10 years, prior to the pandemic, the number of interviews that I had done virtually was, you know, you could count on one hand.
Right.
Via Skype, I think I did a couple of them, but most everything else was in person. Then the pandemic happens and everything I do, and so it flips it, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it got me thinking, and I wanted to talk to you about this, it flipped the experience. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious. I want to talk about the backstory, and I love a good origin story. But I first wanted to ask you, because you mentioned that, how has that dynamic changed for you? Did it turn you into quasi TV stars, where you were actually really good performing in a box and talking to people that way? Because you're look, we're selling, we're storytelling,
mm-hmm, for sure.
We're creating mm-hmm. a narrative. Did it create a little celebrity kind of actor presence in you, or are you just glad that you don't have to do that anymore if you don't have to do it anymore?
I mean, I think for us, and we were talking about this on the way over because we were listening to your most recent podcast where you actually mentioned this data, mm-hmm. how it's flipped. And, you know, for us, it's much of the same, even for people that are local.
Well, we still find that people don't come to the office, and our desire is that, you know, they're there, they're in the room, we can touch materials, we can have that constant, like, that conversation. I was telling Greg, it's almost like, you know, they made the commitment to drive all the way over, and therefore they're gonna stay and really work through things with you. When it's like
virtual,
it's like, okay, well, we've seen it, we'll get back to you. You know, we don't have their, like, attention for any period of time.
Yeah, it seems to kind of wander a little bit.
It's so funny you say that, because I have three screens in my studio, mm-hmm. and I cannot tell you how often, like, I'll be on a Zoom call with somebody, and I'm checking emails, and I'm doing this, and I'm...
Of course.
Just because mm-hmm. as soon as it's not focused completely on
right.
me,
mm-hmm.
I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm out. But in person, it's really, like, if you were to pick up your phone while mm-hmm. we're talking and just start scrolling through your emails, I'd be like, whoa.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Come on. Be
it's
cool.
It's like going to dinner
right.
with you.
Right. Yeah. But when you're in front of the computer, it's just an interesting dynamic. Mm-hmm. Tell me the backstory. How did, because I find that fascinating. I don't know what it is. I love hearing the stories of how people wound up doing what they're doing and how people wind up doing it together. And how the connection took place and why. It's a fascinating idea. And if you think about it, really, there's no reason we should ever wind up working with anybody else. The odds of us working with other people is just so contrary to human nature. It makes sense. Collaboration is not something that comes naturally, but if you learn it, anyway, long story short, I could go on. Tell me the origin story. How'd you wind up working together and how'd you wind up doing this?
Okay. Well, say I should go back prior to that. I'm way back. Right. So essentially, I mean, really far back. So getting my first degree in University of Pittsburgh, in art, like studio arts, nothing to do with actual design work. I had worked at a restaurant and really kind of fell in love with that industry. The restaurant in particular had something like a X factor to it that was beyond the food. It was beyond, you know, the beverages, the service, all that stuff. It was kind of a little bit of a party atmosphere, but the design was something that always struck me at that time, in terms of just the lighting, the minimal decor elements and how they were applied, the artistry, because everything in there was handmade by local artisans, whether it be murals, you know, head to toe murals in the restroom, you know, a plasma cut bar dies, and this is like the mid-90s, where, you know, in Pittsburgh, where you're not seeing a lot of this stuff, and even the countertops, the lighting, the decorative lighting over the bar, everything as small as this restaurant, and it was a 40-seat restaurant, not big, but everything was thought through, and everything was kind of, you know, interesting. So anyway, so having worked there a couple of years, having graduated and then moved to Seattle for a couple of years, I had this epiphany to go back to school for interior design, and I wanted to design restaurants. Moved out to Los Angeles once I completed my degree at University of Cincinnati. Worked in corporate design for a couple of years, 2.5 years, then moved into smaller firms, which I'm, you know, it's more my speed, I guess, you know, just dealing with kind of more bespoke projects and things of that nature. And then we got hit with the Great Recession. And at that time, I had been, in 2008, I was laid off by a small office I was working for. They just work dried up. And then the following year, and I had been laid off, and then I had a job before I even left the office, because I called somebody else immediately in a panic about trying to get work. And yeah, so I was brought into another small office, and then the same thing happened a year later. So lost 2 jobs in the span of a year. And I kind of took stock of the situation and realized that, you know, going out on the market, knowing that I was going to compete for a job with maybe like 400 designers or more, like nationwide at the time, I just decided I was going to cool my jets on that and try to find work in another manner. So anyways, long story short, through a contractor that I was working with at the time, he or had known, I had called him, and he had given me 2 jobs to start with, where I was just assisting another designer. And that is how this started for me. Fast forward, actually, one of those jobs was how I met Terry. So it was a large residential project in the Pacific Palisades, which actually brought me to this place for the first time. We were in need of a millworker to do all of the cabinetry and things of that nature. We wanted to do everything local and custom and not buyout. So I just happened to bump into Terry, who had been working as a cabinet and furniture designer and had her own shop for 13 years that she had just backed out from around that time. And she was working out of another showroom in Silver Lake. And so we were put together by the owner of that venue, that shop, which is no longer there. And yeah, so we just kind of hit it off, and I brought her in to work on this residential project.
Which was not easy. It was the hardest. I think that's actually what got me out of millwork. I had nightmares about that project for 2 years, just, I mean, the level of like we had one vanity that was like this floating vanity. It was 12 feet long. It was covered in like corian, like a solid surface material, but it was just floating on two metal arms. And I'm like,
from one steel post.
I'm like, this is not going to stay up. I would go out and visit because they'd have like, you know, issues with their drawers, and I'd go out and adjust their drawers, and I would like look at the back, and I would see it slowly, like it was pulling away from the wall. And I'm like, can I please put legs on this? And he finally let me put legs on it, and I slept peacefully after that.
Look, sometimes, you know, clients, you just kind of have to force them, or they have to see things destroyed in that train wreck in slow motion until it actually happens. Sometimes isn't that the best way to teach a lesson, is just to let the lesson be taught on its own?
Yeah, I just didn't want it to crush
a child. Sorry, we're laughing, funny.
No, but
those of you with children listening,
nothing happens, which is the good news.
Well, but, listen, you know what? Therein lies, you know, a really good lesson. Mm-hmm. Don't be in such a hurry to be so avant-garde for the sake of but it's 12 feet long and it's got
wouldn't it
a solid,
be great if this floats?
I've never seen one before. Well, maybe there's a reason for that.
Right.
Maybe there's a good reason for that. And isn't that one of the reasons why you hire an architect or a designer in the first place?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but it's kind of there's also the other side of it, which is also, you know, pushing the envelope, right? Mm-hmm. And because where would we be without, you know, testing the boundaries, right? Otherwise, everybody's house would look the same, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so let's explore that idea for a minute. What does that mean? What does that mean to you as far as, I'll back up a second.
Sure.
You know, so I kind of considered, like, I was at KBiz and IBS this year and loved being at that event and seeing all the people, and it was so crowded. But to me, that's kind of like the equivalent of the auto show or a fashion show, right?
Sure.
Because all the manufacturers get to come out, show you what they've been working on. But at the auto show, you get concept cars.
Right.
Yes.
Right? There's no intent to build that mass production. Mm-hmm. They built one of one so you could see what they're capable of doing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then some of that technology makes its way into the everyday run-of-the-mill vehicle. Mm-hmm. You can't really – design houses don't really do that. And I feel like that's the platform to do it.
Well, I think we do in a way. Like when we go through our design process – I mean, it's a little bit different than what you're talking about. But when we go through our design process, we do our concept phase. And it's like, it can be pretty crazy. It's just like, throw whatever ideas you have on the table. And it's like, when we're presenting it, it's like, sometimes it's like too big. It's too big of an idea. But then, you know, you get your feedback from the client, you find out what they really like, and then that gets scaled down. It's like the couture. It's like the runway version of the project. And then you like scale that down for like mass market, in a sense. So I feel like, you know, we do tend to push the limits a little bit and just see what, you know, what lands and what can come of it. Like I think of Cali in San Diego, you know, it's just like this, we wanted this idea of this wave like coming over the bar, and it, you know, it took a lot to build that thing. But, you know, it's, if you don't like think high concept in the very beginning, those types of things won't actually come to fruition.
Yeah. I mean, I would echo all of that. You know, I mean, some of the stuff we've shown in concept, it's not laughable. I wouldn't say it's laughable, but sometimes there's things where, you know, we're working with the designers in our team, and they put out some crazy stuff, and I'm like, I don't even know what that, like, I don't even know where to start with that object, you know? Mm-hmm. I really don't. Like a drop of honey that's actually pouring up from the floor, you know, and like a large scale, like, what do you do with that, you know? But we've oftentimes, like early on, and I don't want to, you know, be the pin in the balloon on a constant manner with our designers, right? You want them to be thinking, you want them to be thinking creatively. Obviously, early on in that process, we need to start looking during schematic design, how are we going to then take that and make it a reality? And what are the trade-offs by making that a reality, basically? You know, like if we can't get the swooping curve, can we do it in facets and then smooth something over it to get the same effect, you know, for instance? So those are the things that I think, you know, you want to be pushing that boundary a little bit. You don't want to crush small children under it. You want to basically, but you know, I mean, the wall wasn't even straight in this house. You know, yeah. It was actually kinked in.
Everything was.
And so this didn't have much meat to even hang on to. So, you know, the architect we were working with on this job, you know, this was all part of the whole idea of the house, right? Yeah. So anyways, it was built. It didn't harm anybody, and
no small children were harmed in the building.
No. And it's, you know, it was beautiful, I think, for a time until it had legs.
Yeah.
Literally. Had legs. I kind of want to drill down on that idea of creativity a little bit, because, you know, sometimes if you have that opportunity, it's like, well, we can put a frame in that will go back into the wall, and then we can build support here if we're thinking about it in advance. But sometimes you got me thinking about that whole idea of the auto show and that whole idea of
right.
being able to create something just like remember Beetlejuice?
Of course.
The movie?
Yes.
That was my first exposure to an interior designer. I remember when I was...
Oh, right. Otto.
Yeah. Good for
or
you.
Otho.
Wow.
Or
Otho. Otho. Yeah. And I remember... I didn't know what an interior designer was. And it's like, they have people that do that in your house. That is the coolest thing ever. And I wouldn't want to live that way, but that's kind of neat. Clients don't often let you explore and expand the space.
Right.
Like sometimes Uber creatives would like to do.
Sure.
But at the same time, to have the opportunity, so you have a firm and you build a reputation, and the bigger the reputation, the longer you've been doing it, the more leeway it gives you to try new things.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah?
I would think so. I mean, and that was a little bit, or not a little bit, I mean, that's kind of the goal. Like I said, you know, sometimes you work at a larger firm, you might have that ability just because there's larger fees, you can kind of burn more time, like, mm-hmm. you
really
know,
think through
looking
things.
Through design mm-hmm. options. However, they're also, maybe because of, you know, like insurance factors, I don't know, they may not be as hyper creative at the end. So working for smaller boutique firms was always something that I was interested in, just because there is that, you know, you feel like you can have that trial and error. You can, you know, come and work with somebody like Michelle here and, you know, work through ideas. But yeah, I mean, I think like for us, I mean, having the knowledge though, of how things work or how things go together, having, you know, been on construction sites, having put together furniture, you know, that base also allows, you know, you're already designing when you're being creative, you're already thinking, you know, it's like chess, right? You're thinking, you're trying to think X amount of moves ahead of the next player. In this case, you know, you're thinking far down the line. When you start a process, you know, like we're start the design process. Like if I'm working on a floor plan, you know, I already know the codes. I already know, like, you know, how much space needs to be between tables. I already know, you know, how to kind of divide the space and thinking about workflow and, you know, where servers are going and are, you know, to the kitchen and, you know, where guests are coming in and all that stuff. And you're thinking through all that stuff when you're doing it, and it takes you much less time. Right, all that knowledge is there, but you're applying it and not kind of going through the motions. Like you can still kind of push the envelope, but you know what? You know where the boundaries are, to some degree. Sometimes you want to go beyond that because, you know, maybe nobody's pushed, and then you can, you know, that's where it's great to collaborate with other vendors, fabricators, etc., to see what can be done, or contractors, what can be done.
Starting your journey,
yes,
on the heels of the Great Recession.
Yes.
How did that inform the manner in which you approached the most recent catastrophic activities, specifically as it relates to the firm, mm-hmm. to the work that you do for your clients, and helping them figure out what it is that they will actually need and want in an ever-changing landscape? And I say that because for the first time that I can really remember, mm-hmm. the pandemic did something that created an experience that everybody had at the same
right.
time, which I can't remember when that actually happened.
Yeah.
And so it affected everybody, And it changed the way everybody lives and experiences with themselves and their own family. I can't remember a time when that actually happened. So everybody's trying to learn in real time how this is going to happen. I think those who started their firms, you know, on the heels of the Great Recession, 08, 09, mm-hmm. how did that help you? How did that maybe prepare you for what was to come?
I was a sole proprietor, like working on my own for probably 2 years before I got my first employees. But I would say that for us, I mean, looking back, I mean, I guess when I first took my second job here in Los Angeles was with a larger architectural firm. And while I didn't think they were pushing boundaries from a design perspective, I did appreciate and respect the type of work they did because I felt like they were recession proof. And I had left that, the comfort of that, right before the recession to go into a small firm, which didn't last.
Great timing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of a lesson learned. And so knowing, because I said, you know, they were trying to acquire other smaller architecture firms in businesses in areas that they weren't in necessarily. So there was a kind of, you know, once you get the plane off the ground with a business, you know, it can grow quickly, it can grow slowly, it becomes, you know, unwieldy at times. I mean, especially if you're just, you know, a designer who didn't go to business school and trying to cobble something together, it's a lot of like, you know, sticking gum on the wings, you know, as you're flying, right? So I would say, you know, especially, you know, you take what you can get to start. And I was just taking jobs until I started getting a foothold in the restaurant industry and then was passed around a lot.
I mean, I think it was mostly prior. I mean, it's always been about building really solid relationships.
Yes.
And I think those really solid relationships keep you on the cusp or on the, you know, in the loop with all the, you know, potential clients out there.
Yeah.
Like, because we've only ever really worked on word of mouth. And I think that, you know, you were developing, without knowing it, I think you were developing relationships, you know, after the recession, up to the pandemic. And I think that just kept us going.
Right. I think, though, I guess my long-winded point was trying to think about, like, you know, COVID hits, we shut down. We lose 85% of our business, which was not an uncommon story, right? And I don't know if there's, I don't know, we never did the math.
It just disappeared,
poof. Yeah. You know, like, I mean, and you've got 9-10 people working in the office, right? Obviously, loans helped. I mean, there was a lot that changed for everybody, and we can talk, like, do a whole podcast about that entire experience. But I think for us, you know, having been through these things before, you know, there was panic initially, sure, what do you do, right? And we had to then maybe pursue some projects that we had turned down previously because we were too busy, that seemed to still be going. So we're like, hey guys, remember when we turned you down?
We're back.
Yeah. Take those. So, you know, it's all about the hustle, like that hustle of trying to get work when you're building a business, but the hustle of trying to get work, especially during super lean times, that helps. Sorry.
do you know what's funny? It's funny. That is the pounding of the metal table with the guy who's wearing the headphones. Yeah. It's funny that you say that, though, because to me, okay, so my, you know, my background is in broadcast. I was in radio sales for a very long time. And it was one of those things where when I hear people say, well, all of our marketing is word of mouth, it makes me cringe a little bit. It's not that you're wrong, because you're not, you know, I get that. That is a strategy. It's a tactic, not a strategy. But I always felt like, especially when talking to designers, and sometimes they will say, you know, I've been through clients that I really didn't want to work with, and everyone's got their I fired that client story.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And it's great, but if you rely exclusively, and this is leading up to a question, not a monologue, about word of mouth.
Yes.
Do you not wind up with the same kind of clients that you currently have because the clients that you have are talking to their friends. Their friends saw your project because that's what they like, and now they're and now you become
right.
sort of self typecast in a way mm-hmm. because you're reaching the same kinds of people. And if I got news for you, if you have a client that's annoying, chances are their friends are annoying too.
I think we're very aware of that.
You know, though, it's interesting. So I think in our industry, and there's a couple of things to bring up. One is that, you know, during the pandemic, and just the kind of close the loop on the previous blathering, is that it was a crossroads for us. I mean, we were at a point where, you know, we're known as hospitality designers. Our expertise is in restaurants specifically. And we had just started getting into hotels as well. And we're looking at each other saying, you know, do we need to take on an office? Do we need to take on a residential project or two or three? Or, you know, where is the money right now for us to keep going? And we had a meeting about it, and I remember this. And we after the, you know, what we came to is that we're gonna just say, you know what, this is who we are, and we're gonna double down on this because we built this reputation, we have this knowledge base, and this is what we're good at. And it's a specialized field.
Very. I mean, I think it's restaurant design is a whole different ballgame. I mean, we've come in after, you know, somebody's hired a residential designer to do a restaurant, and they're just like, it's a nightmare. please come in and fix it.
So do you do front of house and back of house?
We do mostly front of house.
Okay.
So I try to disengage myself.
We try to keep him out of the kitchen, but he's in the kitchen a lot.
Yeah. Okay. So listen, I mean, it's there. It's so close. You can touch it. You can just walk back there.
Why sure. not? Sometimes
yeah, why not? Yeah. Let's go. Let's
sometimes
let's
it's go. Open.
If you can see it, we design it.
Yes. Correct.
Well, and I bring that up
mm-hmm.
because there's another, you know, there's this really interesting dynamic. It's not brand new.
Yeah,
but it's starting to get even more popular. Is that idea of this performative kitchen that is also it's a show.
Mm-hmm.
Now sure. it's part of the experience. You know, being able to see into a kitchen from the dining room.
Right.
You know.
Well, I think OTM was the perfect example of that, like that show kitchen. That was great because it's like he even wanted it so that you could walk through the kitchen to get to the restroom. You know, he wanted people to be in the kitchen and experience the kitchen. And I mean, it was, I loved that project for that very reason. It was a little bit different than what we'd designed in the past.
Now, by the way, I'm not a restaurateur.
Right.
That seems like a terrible idea. No, seriously, knives
and liability.
Knives and
people slipping
and heat and fire and knives.
I haven't heard of any lawsuits yet.
Yeah, no. I mean, they didn't put people on the lines. You walked between.
No, them. I get it. Mm-hmm. I get it. But listen, anyone who's done industry service.
Yeah.
If you've done industry, you know, like
what's happening.
It's not always. Yeah. But that idea of like the chef's table, where there's a table in the kitchen,
mm-hmm.
is just where the kitchen becomes part of the show. It's
sure.
just so novel. Mm-hmm. And it's so it's interesting to me because a friend of mine, someone that I went to high school with. Mm-hmm. He's been on Convo by Design before.
Right.
Is Steve Sampson.
Yeah.
And I love Steve. And we had spoken before. One of the things that are chefs like him, because he considers himself a craftsman, not an artist. Right. So he is recreating something from Northern Italy
that
if you had grandparents in Northern Italy and you go Northern Italy, right? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So you're eating this, it'll remind you, it's like the same thing. There's a performance to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I find so interesting about restaurants and restaurant design. There is so much that goes into what you see and even more into what you don't. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious how you approach that.
Well, I think, you know, I've probably said this a bunch of times now. I always think of like Corbusier's, you know, a house is a machine for living in.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of take that. I think we all take that mantra in our office, or at least some of us. But that's definitely like my ethos for the restaurant itself, that we are, it's a, it's, you have to be a two-headed designer on the project, because you're wearing, we're creating an environment, like an experience, an environment, a place for people to go, you know, transact and spend their hard-earned money to really enjoy themselves on, you know, and for food and beverages to be arriving in a way that was intended by, you know, a craftsman or artist in the kitchen or bar. And, but, you know, there's also this just, I mean, it's constantly moving. You've got a lot of moving parts. It's an engine. The kitchen is like the boiler room, you know, like, you know, on a ship, or like a, you know, some kind of, or not a boiler room on a ship, but like an engine room on a ship. But like, people are, you know, it's constantly moving. You have people running all over the place, you know, and it's got to work for them too. And if you design it in one way, then you better not come in for dinner, you know, because you might hear about it. You know, I mean, there was a project that Terry worked on downtown that unfortunately didn't last. It opened right during COVID, basically. And so it just, unfortunately, it just didn't, downtown, it was a ghost town, right? It has been. So anyway, but we went in there for an event that we had down there. And the staff kept coming over to me, not just one, you know, two, three of them, telling me what a joy it is come to work. Not often you hear that, so it was pretty amazing to hear that. But, you know, that just says we did our job. So it's not just the environment's fantastic, but these people love being there. They're not complaining about where we put, you know, that we didn't put enough of storage or this or that, you know, it made their lives more complicated. It's a hard enough job, right? So if you're not paying attention or doing your homework on what the needs are of the staff and what they're trying to achieve, then I think it's you just haven't done your job. So
how is hospitality design like residential? And by the way, I mean, I get it. It's a different, you know, what you put in has to be more performative because it's taking a beating, right?
Yeah.
But how is it like residential when you think about, you know, residential? It's like when you think about the kitchen and the heart of the home, and it's like that's where life happens. Mm-hmm. But a dining room is a formal dining is very much like a restaurant, right? But if you're designing a restaurant, unless it's a formal restaurant, which we don't see many of those anymore, you want to make it almost comfortable. Like, hospitality has become this mirror for residential living, where you want to feel like a guest or a resident. You want to feel like you live there, like it's part of home.
Right.
How is restaurant design like residential? What principles do you think are always there, or that you try to instill in the design?
Man, I don't know. I'm trying to think what, I mean, I think what's changed in the restaurant world that makes it more like residential is just like you're talking about the chef's table. Like, people want to be, people want, like, we've had many chefs, like namely Rosemary in Chicago, that have said they want it to feel like, you know, they've invited a bunch of their friends over for a backyard barbecue. They want people to feel that comfortable. And to be able to translate that into a space that meets those, or yeah, meets that need, it's tough, but it's mostly just the relationship to the chef. It's like, you know, having them to, you know, in eye contact, you know, the eye contact, the, you know, the, you know, the proximity to the chef, the open kitchen, all of that, I think, is what makes it feel like, you know, it's more of a personal relationship.
Do you involve the chef in the design process?
We really like to. It hasn't happened as much recently. We've been working probably with more of the development people. But, you know, when we do get to work with a chef, it's great because they're very creative people and they've got grand ideas. You know, it just really helps keep the juices going just to hear their story, their process, you know, where they've traveled, what inspired them. It really sets a great ground, base for the concept.
It's interesting to me because, you know, this is one of those things, and I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, because anytime you add a layer of decision maker to the process,
yeah,
right? But then when you're doing residential, you have a client who, generally speaking, doesn't know what they want.
Right.
And we joke about it all the time, the whole thing where it's like, hey, here's Pinterest. Yeah, I mm-hmm. want that. I want that. I right. want that. Yeah, that's not your house. You can't have yeah. that. But we'll do what we can. But when you're talking to developers, they're looking for one thing. You talk to the chef, they're looking for something else.
Sure.
Ultimately, it's what the customer is going to find that they want.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have to match the design
to the food.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that in the one place, and that's where Greg and I actually didn't really, I mean, we had met prior to that, but, you know, Bestia was like one of the first big restaurants that Greg had worked on. I wasn't part of Studio Unlimited at the time. But I think just that relationship between Greg and Genevieve and Ori, just, you know, understanding everyone and understanding what the, you know, what the food was, who they are. Like, you can walk into that place and it just matches the food. It matches their personality. So it's just such a really cohesive design for that very reason.
Yeah. I was just trying to think back of what you were talking about earlier. Yeah, so I mean, I think they're, you know, working with a chef is always invigorating, you know, but it's really honestly whoever the brainchild of the project is, because I often say to when we hire people, I was like, just FYI, you know, if we're working at a restaurant, especially if it's a chef driven or a smaller, you know, like a smaller group, it's about as close to residential clientele that you'll ever have. It is intense. People care deeply about every move you make. They're not letting you just design in a vacuum and just say, okay, bring us whatever. It's great. Love it. You know, you have to put in the work, and it can be a tussle at times, you know, like, but we always have to take a step back for us. I mean, there are certain things that you fight for, right? Certain things that, you know, we've done this before, we know. And there are certain things where, you know, we just have to take a step back, because ultimately, you know, they have the vision. They're serving the food. Maybe they have other restaurants. There's a certain type of hospitality they want to create. And there's also a budget that we have to kind of work in there. So we really have to be respectful, but also firm in terms of the, you know, the knowledge that we have, where it's, you know, we don't want to see them making mistakes, and we don't want to be on the hook for those mistakes, right? So we'll push back in those moments. But it is kind of a fun story. Like, I mean, for instance, Terry brought up Cali in San Diego. The chef there had a cool story. It was very much tied to the design. This was his first solo restaurant. And so, you know, to have aspects of his own story or own personality evident in the design, even if people don't get it, they don't know, they don't understand it, they just think it's cool, right? But it's there, and it means something to him, and it means something to us, you know? And it probably means something to the staff as they get to know him. They probably, you know, get a better sense of what this is about, you know?
So I have an odd question for you, and this just comes from a place of curiosity. Because when you talk to a residential designer, they're designing for the home for, you know, 10 or 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking to an architect, they're building a project that they hope will last 75, 100, 150
right.
years. When you're designing a restaurant, how long do you imagine... And you know, maybe it's like, well, we don't think about that because the end game isn't part of what we do. We're doing a restaurant launch. We want people to feel comfortable in this concept. And then, you know, concepts change all the time. Do you think about the lifespan of a concept?
For some reason, I've always thought 5 years.
Is that right?
I just always feel like it's not that it's going to, you know, I just feel like at that point, that's when they're going to want like a bit of a change, you know, whether it be like a floor plan change, or I just feel like that's like typically when people are just ready for something different,
or things have really
been worn down
to the stubs. You know, like, I mean,
it gets a lot of abuse. Restaurants, tons of abuse.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one. So, I mean, I would say like it does come into consideration. Obviously, I think our approach, generally speaking, unless there's a different request, We try to be, you know, we try to take a timelessness into consideration with all of our designs.
Definitely.
Honestly. And some of them, you know, are 12 years old, like, you know, Bestia at this point, Mess Hall, you know, those are like some of our earliest projects.
But Bestia's even gone through a few, like,
small iterations.
The basis, I mean, the basic concept is still there, but it's gone through like some changes.
And I ask the question, you know, it's kind of a silly question because nobody ever thinks anything they do is going to fail or is going to change. No, in all seriousness, I mean, with a restaurant, it's really interesting because, you know, the concept is the brainchild of someone who's creating something culinary in nature, right? And the restaurant needs to match that. Well, what if people think the food's terrible? That is in no way, shape, or form related to the design. Right. And because of that, restaurants turn over all the time.
Yeah. Sure.
But I think the concept is interesting because now where we go with design, I think design has taken a far more important approach with respect to design, to restaurants and the food, because the experience is more important. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the experience was maybe considered as much, you know, in the past it was, you know, how many tables can we get in and how fast can we flip them? And if we can get four flips on a night and we can.
Right. That hasn't changed.
No.
So tell me something. Yeah, it hasn't, because at the end of the day, at the end of the night, you know, you still need to figure out how to be profitable in a restaurant.
Right.
Where does that fit in your design process?
Oh, interesting.
Like, how many tables can we fit in?
Well, let me be specific.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, maybe it's like, well, the business aspect of it doesn't really take that much importance in the design. But I got to imagine maybe it does.
Yeah, 100%
does. And so at what point, and it's not just how many tables, but it's like, okay, how many four tops can we fit in here?
Yes.
And if we need to turn those fours into eights, eights into 12s, mm-hmm.
how does
12s,
it happen?
How does it happen in the dining room? Mm-hmm. If we need to then break those fours and put in some twos, mm-hmm. how does it work? Do you ever see that video of the, so funny, stupid, where the guy has the jar and he puts in a bunch of golf balls or rocks. He says, is the jar full? And the class says, yes. And then he puts in a bunch of smaller rocks.
Right.
He says, okay, now is it full? And they say, yes. And then he puts in the sand. Is it full now? Yes. And then he puts in water. And says, okay, get the point.
Yeah.
But with a restaurant, okay, you have a finite amount of space. Mm-hmm. So if you have 24 tops, is it full? Yes. Well, what if, right? And then you put some two tops instead. So where does that take place in the process, the economics of how many flips or how many tables
right at
or
the
how
beginning.
Many okay
yeah right at the beginning. So for all of our clients, we put together a program document, like a program questionnaire, so to speak, that we send out or review with them, that breaks down each area of the project, starting like just general overview. It could be high level things like, you know, dining tables, metal, wood, like are there any dislikes, you know, like we just want to take things off the table if they've had bad experiences in the past. You know, most restaurateurs hate the color white, for obvious reasons. So, you know, if there's specific things that they don't like, we want that off the table. We always ask them, what's your mix of twos and fours? Right.
Or, do you like communal? And
yeah,
lately it's no.
You know, how many seats at your bar? How many drink wells at your bar? Right. So all of these things we take into consideration. So we have that data to back up the design. So otherwise you're just heading in blind and you have no plan. And that's why, you know, I think like, you know, that's we put in that time and we know the questions to ask. And we're always learning new questions to ask after each project that we do, depending on like the genre. What's cool about, I think, what we do is that, you know, restaurants aren't just, you know, a mom and pop restaurant or like a, I don't know, like a yard house or something like that. You know what I mean? It's not just, there's so many typologies to what food and beverage means. So, and we get to touch all that. And each one of those has a set of complex requirements. If you're doing an event space, you know, that has its own set of rules and requirements that don't match, you know, a fast casual restaurant.
Next thing that I find absolutely fascinating about restaurant design, and talk to me about the lighting, because
Greg will go on all
I love
day.
It.
How much time do we have left on this?
I love that I hit a nerve. No, it's
very important, but that, and Greg will let you know how important it is.
Yeah. No, I mean, lighting to me is pretty much everything on the job. If, you know, because we have people that maybe, you know, we won't be able to work with because of, you know, our fees or whatnot. But if I ever give them any advice or if I ever give them, you know, a proposal, it'll focus mainly on that, because you can take a small space and change nothing else and transform it with lighting, at least, you know, assuming they're not a breakfast restaurant, which, you know, would be a problematic thing. But you know, I was thinking about this when I was writing some notes about a recent project that we just opened in Fresno. And it also ties into your other statements or questions or comments before about how the restaurant industry, or at least, you know, has elevated, you know, the design is such a component of this. And I, you know, invite you to read all of the Yelp reviews from this restaurant. It's called Saison in Fresno, and Saison with a Z.
Saison.
Anyways, they, you know, like, people freak out about the design. They love it. It makes them feel like they're not in Fresno. And you get that over and over and over and over. It's pretty interesting, you know, because it just shows you, man, they're just, because they're in a tertiary market, they need something, right? And they there's no, why, like, why is it all in the big cities, you know? And you go to smaller cities. Anyways, that's a tangent. So that space in particular is, you know, it's a daytime. It can be a daytime restaurant. They do want to work at brunch in. They haven't opened for brunch. But, it, you know, being outside, and you know, in the early part of the day, it's beautiful. It's very lush, almost like, you know, Tulum-esque feelings on the patio and things like that, right? And then the space itself has, you know, it's a relatively new build, so it's got a lot of, you know, tall windows all around the space, bathed in light. It's a different game at night, right? I mean, it really transforms from day to night beautifully. And a lot of that is, you know, due to our lighting designer, Becky, at the office. I mean, we use her on every project, and she's probably, you know, exhausted. but, I mean, it's a lot of effort, and it's a huge expense too, to get it right, because, you know, the principles of lighting don't really change per job. That's one thing that's very, very consistent that we try to keep, you know, making sure the food is popping on the table. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how many restaurants I go in, like Michelin star restaurants, that just, you can't take a picture of your food. You wouldn't want to. It looks yellow, right? You know, or it's flickering, you know, like, you know, when you open up your camera. So, I mean, people are there to eat. I mean, they're coming back for the food. And it always bums me out that, like, man, this would look so great if you could see the colors, you know, like as the chef intended it.
It's right? An experience.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's a full experience. It's supposed to be a full experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's visual. It's tactile. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the taste, the smell. All of, it's a full, you know, the full, I guess, like a carnival of the senses, right?
Carnival of the senses.
And you're missing a huge component of it.
So I'm curious about something else, and I don't know if you do this, but one thing that I just think is absolutely fascinating, from LA to New York and everywhere in between that I have been,
yeah,
in the pandemic, the restaurant experience, because restaurants were hit so hard, mm-hmm. This idea of street side dining and restaurants taking place of in basically
parklets,
parking spots, yeah. Right? So when I first saw them, it was basically like tables on sawhorses, like everyone's just panicking, right? Mm-hmm. Then I went to New York on a trip, and I saw what some people were doing, you know, everything from Maid and Target and Home Depot up to spaces that were actually well-designed, mm-hmm. well-thought out. Mm-hmm. Do you think about that? Did you do it? Is there a future in that?
I mean, I don't think we really... I think we kind of did it at M. Georgina at the Row, like, you know, thinking about what the parklets or, you know, what the outdoor coverage could be. She was looking at maybe doing a PDR, but we never really came across that. I think currently we really haven't been designing towards that, but we've been designing a lot more outdoor patios. Like in LA, it's just hilarious how I don't understand why prior to the pandemic we didn't have outdoor dining. Like, it's LA. It's like perfect weather all year round, but we're a bunch of wimps. But now,
thin-skinned.
Yeah.
Is it that, or is it just laziness?
I think people just don't like to be cold. They like to be indoor. They like to be cozy, you know. But now, I mean, I think people are starting to discover you can design these beautiful patio spaces with coverage, with heaters, and just have a much, like, now people want to dine outside.
Yeah, the interiors are empty if there's a great patio.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I walked past Gracias Madre the other night, and the interior was, nobody was there. And mm-hmm. I was like, where is everybody? Walk to the patio. Right.
So, as a designer mm-hmm. in that particular space,
yeah.
do you view that as competition? It's like, well, wait a minute. Do you know yes. what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
wait a minute. I design. Mm-hmm. You can't go outside. No, yeah. the weather may be nice, but I want you inside, and I'm going to redesign. I'm going to refresh. I'm going to come up. Does that challenge you to come up with other ways to make the experience greater, to bring them back inside, to experience what you design?
I've been loving. Like, we're working on two projects right now. One in Altadena, and one
working on more than two projects.
Well, sorry.
There are two
we and my
there
team.
Are, there are two projects in which we are working. That,
there you go. Thank you.
Yeah.
One of them is in Altadena. One of them is Santa Monica. And they're both really outdoor focused. And they both want these really lush, meandering patios. And I'm really enjoying, you know, that process and just making that outdoor space equal to, you know, the design that we're working on the indoor, so that it's like it doubles their seating and they don't have to like just force people out onto the patio when they just have too many people. Like, people want to sit out there as much as they want to sit on the interior.
Right. I mean, I think sometimes the location dictates a lot of that. Like, for instance, we did Nick's on Beverly, which is a plant-based restaurant, and it was honestly like, I mean, kind of a lower budget flip of an existing restaurant. And so there were a lot of things that we capped. But one of the goals was to try and get people indoors because, you know, it's half the space is outside, half it's indoors.
Well, it's a beautiful patio.
But that patio has been there forever.
Yeah.
And the patio is relatively unchanged for 30 years. You know, I think it was like Pontevino, and then it was, I can't remember.
It started with
Terrain.
A T. Yeah, Terrain.
And then there might have been something even older than that. But that patio and the tree that's back there that's just like pushing out of the ground, it's just going up and up and up, you know, it's been there forever, and people just, that's why they're there. You know, I mean, not to say now the food is quite good, but the interior, like, you know, we tried to add some biophilia inside the restaurant, and add a little bit of that garden feeling inside the restaurant, color, you know, tried to make it just more, because it was pretty bland, what had been there right previously. The seating layout was very confining and stuff like that. So we really wanted to change what that felt like. I couldn't tell you if it ended up working, you know, on the regular. You know, when I go there, people do sit inside. But, I mean, it's impossible to compete with that patio.
So plant-based, too, because this has become so popular.
Yeah.
Do you look for ways to use traditionally wasted wall space for gardening purposes and to add biophilia? And how has biophilia and how has incorporating plants worked into your overall design concept?
Well, probably started with Bovell. Just this need. I mean, we did that and it just worked out so well. And it's like, oh man, why don't we do this more in spaces? Because that's beautiful. I mean, I come from Montana. I was always surrounded by nature and a gardener, you know, my mother. But I love it. Just greenery just adds that an additional layer or an additional color to the space. Plus, you know, after the pandemic, people just, you could almost use it as a screening element. People felt more comfortable when there was like plant life on the inside, mm-hmm. Oddly enough. But
everybody wants it now.
Everybody wants it. It's you know, it's now it's like, instead of that, why not put a bird on it? It's like, why not put a plant in there in it? And it's like, you know, it almost went to the point of like, we can't just design with plants. You know, we have to think, you know, first, like how to make a beautiful space, and then we can layer some plants in. It can't always be about the plant feature. But yeah, I mean, I think going forward, our probably most of our spaces will have some kind of a biophilic element to it.
Well,
to
them. It's funny because when you said that, and by the way, I'm making this way longer than I have to because I'm fascinated by this, but it's funny because if you couldn't tell, I spent enough time in the service industry, so I totally get this.
Yeah, and lingo.
I'm fascinated by it because as soon as you talk about, you know, yes, biophilia, everybody wants to be around nature. It's, mm-hmm. it's natural. It's ingrained in us. And then I'm starting to think, well, if you put living things in a restaurant, then that's more side work, and then someone's got to water it, and someone's got to take care of it. And then
that is,
do you, when you're thinking about your restaurant design, do you think about side work, and do you?
Oh, yeah.
You do?
Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't in the beginning, because we didn't really think about it, especially with, I mean, we kind of did, because...
Side work being... like roll-ups and stuff like that.
Yes.
Sorry. You're talking about...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, we're talking about two different... You go. Okay.
No.
What's the side work that you're talking about? Because in the restaurant industry, side work is basically what the servers have to do, like, before they can leave and go home.
Right.
All the stuff that you have to... The roll-ups and the filled the salt and pepper shakers and the ketchup and the water... They don't happen by themselves. People actually have to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Go ahead.
You mean just basically... I mean, we definitely have, like... clients that come to us, and I might not be following you, but you know, we're like, let's put some greenery here, and they're like, well, who's going to take care of it? How much is that going to cost?
Exactly.
Like, who do I have to hire?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And so we try to be respectful of that, and we do. You know, there are maintenance programs that are actually quite inexpensive. You know, it's a lot of bang for your buck, really. Like, you know, what, $450 a month just to come in and water plants. The other thing you have to think about is just the bugs. You know. Mm-hmm. Plants attract bugs, so there has to be like a pest control, you know,
moisture.
yeah, you don't want dripping on people's heads as they're eating.
Yeah, that's not good.
It happens. These are living items.
Yes.
Yeah. Everybody who's dined at Bevel has been dripped on at some point.
Right.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It is. That's fantastic.
I mean, it's like eating in a jungle.
Yeah. No, I love that.
It's, but I mean, to your point, you know, just going back to that, yes, it's obviously like, it's not the dishwasher who's going to be watering plants.
No.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And most are pretty candid. They're like, we just need fake plants.
All right.
Well, and that's difficult. I mean, it's really a struggle for us when somebody is like, we don't want real plants, we want fake plants. And it's just...
We want to bring in a 1,000-year-old olive tree that we're going to plant in the middle of the restaurant, and it's going to be the focal point for everything.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, when I start talking about 1,000-year-old olive trees and side work in restaurants, I think I've pretty much covered what we came here to talk about today, of which I am incredibly thankful that you both took the time to do this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is great.
This has been another episode of Doctoring Up Design, featuring an incredible conversation with Greg and Terry from Studio Unlimited. Thank you so much for your time and talent. I appreciate the conversation. This podcast is presented by Design Hardware. Thank you, Michelle Solomons and Avi Balsam with Design Hardware, for making this platform available and for your tireless support of the design and architecture community. Thank you for listening and subscribing to Doctoring Up Design. Please make sure you are subscribing to the show so you don't miss a single episode. You can find all the links in the show notes. See you next time.